It's the Real Faith for Real Life podcast. Hey, everybody. A lot of great things today. We're going to continue answering your hardest questions, including one about politics and religion. So stay tuned for that. But as always, faith intersects with every part of life. So we want to first check in on the headlines. All right, with me again today, Pastor Eric.
Hey, hey.
And JP Gaylord.
Hi, everybody.
So today we have two stories as usual, and just looking for various ways that faith intersects with real life, everyday life.
Before you begin this,
yeah,
do you want to make a wager as to whether or not Bill will begin giggling like he did last time?
I don't want to make the wager. We don't know the stories.
We don't know the stories. That's why I think this is fun.
Giggling this time, but if you missed the last show, you got to go back.
Yeah, I'll get your cup of coffee tomorrow if he giggles. Yeah. If he doesn't,
oh no, I might have just done it.
Oh yeah,
I might have just done it.
Here we go.
All right, so first story today. Hey, Eric, what did you want to be when you were little?
Well, I really wanted to be a rock climber.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a rock star.
No.
That'd be cool, too.
Rock climber, yeah.
Rock climber. And JP, what do you want to be when you grow up?
You need to give me a specific age. When I was five?
Currently.
Currently?
No, I'm just kidding. Five is good. What do you want to...
That point, it was probably a pilot.
Okay, can you guess what the number one... Oh, by the way, pilot, that's super cool.
I
could still go for that.
I could too. Yeah, but I've heard your stories of flight simulator. Yeah. I'm not letting you go down that track.
So here's a question for you. What do you think Gen Z, what's their number one thing they want to be when they grow up?
We could probably say at the same time. 1, 2, 3. Influencer.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's good. What I thought. Yeah.
Check out these stats. So 57% of Gen Z said they'd become an influencer if given the choice.
Yep.
And 30% said they would even pay for the opportunity. I don't think they understand how this making a living thing works. Another poll found that Gen Zers hope to become influencers as their top career path, with 20% of men and 13% of women saying it was their only intended career path. They're putting all their eggs in the influencer basket. What do you think, Eric? You want to be an influencer?
Well, I like to be able to use my influence for good things.
Hello.
However, I don't think I want to be an influencer. I've watched a bunch of different people rise to fame and then fall and crash because there's just so many eyes on them. And who would want to choose for the rest of my life? I really hope people watch me with a microscope and judge all that I do. That sounds terrible.
Can I ask a question? When you say Gen Z, are we talking about like kids or
like your
adolescents?
Kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have a huge Social Security crisis in about 15 years.
It's coming. It's coming. Yeah, I love this story. It points out why they want to be. They see these kids on YouTube. They get everything for free. They just play video games, and other people watch them play video games, and companies send them all kinds of stuff, free products, food, trips, event access, everything for free. But it does come with a cost, like you mentioned, Eric. All those eyes on you? Ooh, that's difficult. To bring in the faith element, I think you alluded to something really interesting, and that is all of us, to some extent, are influencers. And we just have to realize that we are influencing people, the people in our workplaces, our families, of course, for Christ or not for Christ. We're making a difference. We're influencing people. And oftentimes we're not aware of the influence we do have, always seeking more. But God has given each of us some influence.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to our next story. This one's kind of related. It's about kids doing the craziest things. I don't know if either one of you have ever...
That's a giggle.
It counts. That's two coffees,
yeah,
Eric.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Kids do the craziest things. I don't know if either one of your kids have ever done this, like using your credit card to buy a banana suit in Fortnite or any of these upgrades in iPhone games or just games in general. Last year, the FTC told Epic Games to pay $520 million in penalties to resolve complaints surrounding kids doing this sort of thing. So they did not, they weren't honest in their presentation of what you're buying and how much it costs and all that. Some researchers call it dark user interface, dark UI. It's like that time when you're reading some text online and the button they want you to press to upgrade is like red and it's big and it's solid. And then the skips to the next step is like a little tiny gray text underneath. Mm. You know, every time I log into my credit card, it's like, do you want electronic statements? Wah! Or do you not? You want paper, little tiny text. That's dark UI.
It's like the game within the game is to find the X, you know, the X that you click to close it out. It always shows up in a different place. And you don't know if you're not seeing it or if you just have to wait a certain amount of time.
Yeah. And then they make the target area so small, you have to press it with pixel precision or else you end up clicking the ad.
Yep.
That's dark UI.
Yep.
Dark user interface design. I hate it, especially for people like my mom. Hi, Mom, if you're watching. I mean, I feel like I'm a pretty tech-savvy person. I still struggle to find the right link sometimes. How in the world are less experienced or older people supposed to exist in this world without just constantly getting scammed? And not by thieves, but by these actual companies?
Yep.
I'm just on a rant now.
Yeah, for the younger generation, I would say it's something different. Like, if you were to measure the number of kids that actually want a banana suit in Fortnite, that probably is fairly low if they had no outside influence. But the problem is there are these big name people that people are watching online or these kids are watching online. And then that person wears the banana suit. And now all of a sudden, instead of 5% want this goofy little thing, 95% of people want it because it's the thing to do. And obviously companies love that. And then kids are just like, I need to have it. I need to have it. Which obviously could go down the path of how we parent. But let's not even go there.
Yeah, another topic for another day.
Definitely.
But to bring in the faith aspect of this, greed, man, like for these companies that design these things, how much is enough? How much do you have to deceive your own customer into doing something you want them to do versus just offering something so good that they'll by their own free will choose it? You know, it feels manipulative. It feels like yet another proof of the doctrine of total depravity. Well, great discussion with these stories, and it actually ties into our next segment, as we're going to see momentarily. So let's dive into some more of the tough questions you all have submitted about God and the Christian faith and about the Bible. Guys, are you ready for the hardest question yet this season?
Bring it on.
It's a short one, but we're all going to get canceled at the end of this episode, depending on how carefully we answer this. Are you ready? What does the Bible say about politics?
Ooh, just a nice, quick, easy one, right?
Yeah. Well, this question could go a ton of different directions, and I've got three total questions for us today. But listen, this is so important and so relevant that if we spend the entire time just talking about this one question, that's fine with me. So let's just see where the discussion goes. Mm-hmm. I see, Eric, on your computer, you've got open the same passage I've got open.
Yeah.
So walk us through Romans 13.
Yeah, would you like me to just read it?
Yeah.
Okay. Romans 13, 1 through 7 says this, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience." So we'll just stop right there.
Yeah, we'll pause. I think verse 6 has some useful things too, but let's pause and take that much in. Camp out on Romans 13, 1 through 5 for just a little bit. What does this teach us? The very first thing is that if there is someone in power in government, it is because God has established that person to be in that position. Difficult pill for some people to swallow, but it's an an outcropping, what's the word, an implication of the sovereignty of God. There are no accidents in our lives. There's no accidents on the world stage either. And so, with that in mind, whoever rebels against that authority is rebelling against God. All right. So what do we think about this, these verses so far before we move on?
I think there's a lot in that section. I think the biggest thing that you said is kind of the supremacy of God, right? That God remains in control with whoever serves in their leadership position. And, you know, we might be thinking like, well, how can God choose this person to serve because I don't like the way that they're leading? Well, you know, just as a wide view picture, there are a lot of things that God is going to suggest for us to do or tell us to do that we're not going to like because we're people of sin and we rebel and we do our own thing. So it's not uncommon for us to look at a leader and say, I don't like the way that person's leading, or I don't even like that person per se. But that God is still the ultimate creator. He holds all things in his hands. Kind of this picture of like a baker and, you know, baking up the kingdom of God. We'll just use that as an example. We might look at it and be like, no, we don't want that ingredient in there. Don't put the flour in there. Well, God's like, that's part of my big plan. I'm making this beautiful thing. I'm baking this beautiful outcome. And I still stand in control of it all. Let's not leave out this piece, but there is a purpose for this person to be there or this ingredient to be in the middle of what's happening.
Yeah, and before we too quickly try to write off Romans 13, like, oh, that was a different era, and look at the world today, and how could we ever submit to Trump, or how could we ever submit to Biden? Think about who Paul was talking about submitting to.
I believe it would likely be Nero, who was also the guy who started a fire in Rome, blamed it on the Christians, and then launched kind of widespread persecution of Christians throughout the empire. And just to clarify, widespread persecution doesn't mean people making fun of Christians or saying, we don't like you. It means he would literally impale them on poles in his garden and then light them on fire during parties to light the party. This was pretty much evil at its climax. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
to the point where early Christians thought that Nero had to be the Antichrist.
Yeah, feeding Christians to lions for sport and having spectators gather and fill coliseums to watch. I mean, it's unlike anything we face today. And in that context, Paul says, submit not only because you fear punishment, but as a matter of conscience, because God has, in his sovereignty, put this person in this position to fulfill a specific role in society.
But to clarify, I think the is a general principle, Paul's saying submit to authority, but he's not saying blindly submit to authority in anything and everything. You see throughout the New Testament people resisting authority, especially I think of the disciples. I think it's John and Peter in Acts 4 where the Sanhedrin is trying to prohibit them from speaking in the name of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And as rulers over the Jewish people, they should have authority over Peter and John. And Peter and John's response is, well, you judge for yourself whether it's right to obey man or to obey God. Yeah. And so I don't think this passage necessarily means, you know, whatever leaders do is right, or we need to do whatever leaders do or say we need to do. But I think as a general principle, submission to authority should probably be our first response. And then if there are reasons not to, it should probably be prayed through, discussed pretty thoroughly, and it should probably be gospel-centric and like, hey, we are obligated by God to disobey this.
Right. So God is the first authority. And if someone else, whoever it is in your life, is telling you to do something that would cause you to break his law, if you're ordered to murder somebody, for instance, or not proclaim the gospel, then you're honor bound to obey your higher authority, not your lesser authority. So, yeah, I had that verse open too. I think that's from Acts 5, but it's all throughout the first chapters of Acts. And I also have open here still Romans 13. So continuing on, I love how this verse, this chapter continues in verse 6. It says, this is also why you pay taxes, For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. So Paul is basically saying this government that is existing at the current moment to kill you and persecute you and destroy the faith, pay them their taxes. It's pretty wild if you think about it. So in modern day times, for us to be like, well, I don't really enjoy the way the government is spending my money, so I'm just going to fudge the numbers and I'm not going to pay what is due. Totally foreign concept to Paul, and by the way, to Jesus as well. So in Matthew 20:21, he says, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. So, yeah, I don't know what to make of that, but we owe the government certain things, respect and taxes, and we owe to God certain things as well, our entire lives, our obedience, our loyalty. One thing that the Bible says we owe our government is our prayers, by the way. And so 1 Timothy 2:1, I urge then, first of all, that petitions, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and for all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in godliness and holiness. So, yeah, we're supposed to pray for our leaders. What a revolutionary concept. Hmm. Is that part of your prayer life?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I know I would, man, that it doesn't naturally rise to the top of my prayer life.
It doesn't rise to the top of my prayer life.
It should, I guess, huh?
Yeah. I think what it does is it creates a picture of what Christ has called us to do, and that's to love one another. Christ came and loved us in our sin, and just as like authorities serve, they are also struggling with sin in their own way, and we struggle with sin in our own way. Sin pervades all things, and we should recognize that and then make it a practice of submitting each of those people and those sins to God. Like, that's why we have times of confession and worship, and it's something that I look forward to, like an opportunity to do a lot of deep introspection to say, hey, what is going on here, and am I submitting it to God? Am I submitting my trust to God and the fact for each political leader or with each political leader being in their position? Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean, that's hard. It's hard to pray for people you don't like. I remember a girl from college, she shared a story about how there was this coworker she had, and the coworker was just the worst. Oh man, she's the worst. Mm-hmm. And she felt God was saying that you're going to pray for her every day for the next 40 days. And she was faithful in that, and God really changed her perspective on this person. They weren't best friends at the end of it, but she had a love for this person in a new way, a patience for this person in a new way. And I wonder if that might not just be something for us too, that as we look at people in authority positions over us, if we took a certain amount of days of just praying for them day after day after day, if the Spirit might work in our hearts and change the perspective with which we use to look at that person.
Yeah. Even, the call to love people, including loving your enemies, and to pray for people and pray for your enemies is like, it includes political, quote unquote, enemies, right? It's almost like in my sermon recently, I said we tend to draw lines and create boundaries for who we're required to love. Which is a funny thing to say out loud, but we do that, right? Mm-hmm. So if you watch enough cable TV news, there's definitely an in-group and an out-group. There's people who love our country and people who want to destroy our country, according to them, to keep you watching and to make money from their advertisers. Nothing motivates you to watch more than fear. So if they can keep you afraid, you'll keep watching. They'll keep making money. So there's the in-group, there's you, and then there's the out-group, the people who want to destroy the country. And if you watch enough of that rhetoric, you do exempt them from the great commandment. You're like, yeah, I am duty bound, according to cable TV news, not to love these people, but to hate these people and to destroy them almost. So I don't know. These verses are really instructive. You know, submitting to the government is God's will, except when it violates directly with his will. And paying taxes is God's will. Giving them respect, praying for them is God's will. But it's difficult. From my point of view as a church leader living and trying to lead a church through this turbulent time, I would just like to say we have not, speaking for the church as a whole, not this particular church, but church leaders as a whole in America have made some pretty big missteps in going through this particular season. I just was reading this book that just came out. It's about de-churching. It's called The Great De-Churching. Fantastic book. Did you realize that 40 million American adults who used to go to church no longer go to church over the past 25 years? That's like 15, 16% of American adults have walked away from church pretty much permanently. And here's a stat for you. 18% of those listed as one reason, political disagreements with their congregation. 16% because of political disagreements with their pastor. So, wow, that's crazy to me. That's crazy to me that I think there's both ends of this are a little wrong. Like some church people, some Christians have elevated secondary issues to primary issues, have been listening to too much cable TV. And if the pastor says something, it says one thing that aligns with the other side, then he's the enemy. He must be destroyed, must be stamped out, or I got to leave. And on the other side, some churches have also done the same thing and made secondary things primary things. And they've aligned themselves too closely with one party or the other. And they've offended half of the people in the country where those half of the people would never attend that church. Okay, I'm going to get off my soapbox. I'm disheartened by that development in Christianity.
Right. And I mean, there's a government that we do need to obey, per our initial part of the conversation. At the same time, let's just obey it and focus on the things God is calling us to focus on and not get caught up in the song and dance and, you know, what politicians seem to be decrying or, you know, moaning about. Because for us as Christians, there is a king who is coming back. Who has asked the question, will the Son of Man find faith on the earth when he comes back? Mm-hmm. And I fear that as we get caught up in politics and rhetoric and the back and forth between both sides, I fear that we're doing that at the expense of the kingdom of God in our own lives and around us.
What's interesting to me in Jesus, the way he interacts with people, even that verse we read earlier, if he wanted to build an earthly kingdom and Christianize Rome and take over, and he could have done that, but he instead said, no, give to Caesar what's Caesar's,
yeah,
and give to God what's God's. And I'm not going to worry about that. What I'm worried about is your eternal soul. And so there's this mission. I think we, like you just said, we get so easily distracted from the real mission that Christ has given us, because if you get too deep into politics, the new mission is stomp out conservatism because it's going to kill us, or stomp out liberalism because it's going to kill us. And the real mission is much bigger than that. It's concerning people's eternal souls and the gospel. And so we've made, many Christians have this alternate mission now of saving a country rather than saving people. And I don't think you see that in Jesus. I don't think you see him trying to save Rome or trying to save any particular country. He's saving people from every tribe and people group, as he has urged us to do. And in that book I just referenced, the Great De-Churching, I don't have the stat right here in front of me, but this is a crazy stat. Among the evangelicals who walked away from the church, ex-evangelicals, they're no longer part of a church, but almost a quarter to a third of them say that this should be a Christian nation. I mean, take that in. So they want America to be a Christian nation, but they're not part of a church. So there's something going on here where people want to save the country, but they've given up on the church. Oh, man, that just is so, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, this is a hard conversation for me. Bill, you know that I'm fairly apolitical, and it's just not my...
That's how you stay so happy.
I'm so happy. But
sorry, that was definitely a good one. That's a big old large coffee.
When I think about this, though, I guess I kind of look at, you know, maybe like an org chart in a business that no matter what, no matter who stands where on the org chart here on earth, that God still stands at the top of that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if what's making the church overseas... thrive and what's making the church here in the West kind of like diminish is just an inability to for introspection and submission and humility. Like we need to submit to God and allow his big plan to be the center of what we're doing. We need to humble ourselves to say that, yeah, guess what? We don't have it all figured out, but God does, and that's still okay. And I'm probably not describing that very well. I'm trying to like think on the edge of my seat here, but I think humility is a piece of what will save what the enemy is using to rip apart our churches.
Absolutely. I think part of humility is understanding at the core, we all want the same thing. Our people on the other political side, they basically want the same thing as me. We all want the country to be great. We all want life to be good. We all want freedom to assemble and worship and want to take care of people. And when you get in your Facebook algorithm so deep, you never encounter the other side, or when you watch only one cable news station, you kind of lose sight that we have different approaches to reach that goal, but nobody hates this country. Nobody is actively trying to kill this country. I shouldn't say nobody, but 99.9% of people want the same thing you do, and they have a different philosophy about how to get there, and that's okay. In our system, it's good that those extreme viewpoints have to come together and have to work together, and we end up at a place of moderation. That's a good thing. And in fact, most people are moderates, and our crazy system just pushes people toward the edges. But that's another topic for another day. But yeah, if we can hear Jesus say, you got to love your enemies, including your political enemies, and loving starts with listening, man, how much of a dent could we make in the problems facing this country? Well, there could be a ton more things to say, but we'll stop there so we won't get canceled. Hopefully we've said nothing that offends anybody. I mean, that's the problem, right? Like you, in the world, it's so divided. As a pastor, you end up just stepping around landmines. You're always looking, what can I say? What can I not say? And that's collateral damage. The preaching becomes a little watered down because you can't even use an example from real news, an apolitical example, because it has appeared on Fox News and it has appeared on MSNBC, and everybody listening is coming into that, and it's no longer just a sermon illustration. It's a talking point. And anyway, so welcome to our world. It's an interesting and wild time to be alive, but it's also an interesting time to try to be a pastor. So hopefully we've done that discussion charitably and fairly and non-controversially as much as possible.
Yeah.
All right. There's a couple other questions that are related, so I'm going to throw them out. Maybe the discussion's a little quicker, but you know what? I just looked at the question. It's not quicker. It's one that deserves a long treatment too. Why don't we throw that to the next episode? Because this next question I'm so excited about, and it deserves quite a long discussion too. So let's do that.
That sounds great.
All right. So man, teaser for next week's episode. You got to come back. You're not going to believe this question. It's going to be so helpful to you. It's going to revolutionize your life. Yeah. So come back.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you next week on the Real Faith for Real Life podcast.